Hey, folks, Rob Wolf, Greg Everett, we're in the house. It's episode 124 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. What's going on, man?
Wow. You know, I'm a little thrown off since we're recording this on a Monday instead of a Friday, but otherwise, it's everything's going great.
Sweet. Yeah, Paleo FX kind of threw off the usual recording scheme for us, but we're going to rally. We're going to get this baby out, so...
Yeah.
Anything new? Anything exciting?
Well, yeah, I'll have a new product out by the time this thing comes out, most likely.
Sweet.
A little ebook collection of articles, whatnot, what have you, that I've done over the last 7 years or so. And so, like I said, that should be coming out today.
Nice.
Which means when you're listening to this, it was yesterday. So check that out.
So we have some sort of space-time congruence going on there. So, Greg, I've got to ask. I'm not familiar with your work. What's your area of expertise?
The internet.
Greg and I were having some offline banter before we started. So what else is new? So Paleo FX was a ton of fun. Lots of people there. Really well-organized. University of Texas. It was at the Stark Center, which they have this huge... physical culture museum, which was super cool. I think it was largely donated by Joe and Betty Weeder, and they had all kinds of cool stuff in there. Met a ton of folks. Pretty cool gig, other than I got 3 hours of sleep both nights that I was there, and that was a pretty good kick to the jimmy. But what's a girl
to
do?
So I take it Charles Whitman was not in attendance.
Who's Charles Whitman?
He's the sniper guy.
Sorry, dude. I have no idea what you're talking about.
University of Texas, up in the bell tower.
Oh, the bell tower. Okay, sorry. Yes.
He was not paleo.
There. No, he was not there. Sorry, man. I don't know him by name. I just know, the dude in the bell tower. So
that's Quasimodo, I think, if you put it that way.
Gotcha. The dead man.
Okay. All right. Well, now that we are done talking about... shootings and paleo and whatnot, let's talk about balls.
Big ass balls. Okay.
Serena says, "Hey there, in an attempt to get my sleep in check, I'm quitting my night job and taking a desk day job. Is there any benefit to sitting on one of those big exercise balls? Thanks."
Short answer, I guess, would be yes. I try to break up how I'm sitting. I have a pretty nice desk chair that I got from Dania. It's a Scandinavian designs place, so it's kind of cool orthopedic stuff. And that thing will allow me to sit kind of Indian style cross-legged pretty comfortably. And I'll set my timer and I'll sit for 45 minutes like that. Then when the timer goes off, I'll jump up, do quick little bit of mobility work and stretching. Then I'll sit kind of regular, timer goes off, and then I'll jump on the exercise ball. And I just kind of rotate through with that. And I definitely seem to feel better as far as just my hips and all the orthopedic stuff. So I think switching it up however you can is good. I don't know that the exercise balls are the cure for all cancer or whatever, but I think they're legit, and just trying to mix it up will definitely help how you're feeling in the lower extremities and your neck and all that stuff.
So we have a client who used to be an editor at Penthouse. And apparently in her office there were a handful of people who all sat on those big blue Swiss balls. And so that group of editors was just called the Blue Balls, which is kind of funny if they're working for Penthouse. Beyond that, I have no advice other than what Rob said. At least it'll be something different. But I honestly think that if you are only doing that, you're probably going to run into problems too, because you will find a way to adapt and get lazy and hunch over.
Yeah.
So I think mixing it up is probably a better idea.
Totes.
Sit on the edge of your chair instead of sitting back like I do and slouching. All right. Paleo versus Ripito and his gallon of whole milk. This reminds me of the t-shirt you guys had made with the piece of toast fighting the cup of coffee.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay, Tim says, "Hey guys, I went to a starting strength seminar in Redmond, Washington recently. I was told by Mark Ripito and some other coaches that I need to put on 40 pounds. Never heard that before. I'm 6'4" and weigh 220 right now. I really don't want to weigh 260. Of course, the advice of Ripito is to drink a gallon of whole milk every day. I mentioned that I eat paleo, and he said something about biochemistry BS. he actually made me finish his double bacon meatloaf and mashed potatoes when we were eating dinner Saturday night. What I want to know is why didn't he finish his own double bacon meatloaf and mashed potatoes? How many people can say that they finished Mark Ripito's dinner? Oh, man. There's so many things I want to say about that. He said I would lift better the next day. I do want to get stronger, hence the reason I forked out the dough to attend the seminar, but I do not want to chug a gallon of whole milk a day. Do you think someone can see the same strength gains eating paleo as someone who consumes the gallon of milk a day? Are there certain foods I should be concentrating on consuming to help with strength gains and recovery? Anything I should eat pre and post-workout to maximize my training? On a side note, the owner of the facility we were at mentioned he stayed with you in a hotel room once and he woke up at 0300 to find you eating a can of sardines while doing a handstand. What is up with that? Thanks for your input, Tim.
Don't ask, don't tell deal on the handstand and the sardines. So.
it's a myth.
Looking at this thing, there is some juicy material here, but you know, I've just got to ask first off, kind of like, you know, what are your goals? What are you trying to do? 6'4", 220, if you're reasonably lean, you know, you probably could carry a good amount of muscle. You could probably get really strong. Definitely just adding body weight is a really quick, easy way to get stronger, but you know, absolute strength goes up, relative strength goes down, body weight stuff gets more difficult. What are you trying to do? Do you want to look like a fire plug or do you want to look like a kind of lean, strong, jacked athlete? You know, I mean, it really depends on how you want to steer the boat. And then it's just kind of funny, this whole idea that, like, you know, paleo provides inadequate calories. You know, we've done this stuff with, like, the 1,000-calorie curry and the 1,000-calorie omelet and stuff like that. Like, it's really easy to get 4,000 to 6,000 calories a day eating just basic paleo gig, and it's been kind of nice, kind of vindicating. You know, we've always had Wellborn floating around out there that, you know, the dude runs anywhere from like 300 to 330 pounds, depending on if he's doing triples versus singles and depending on whether or not he had a large bowel movement that day, you know. So, and you know, he finds that if he eats paleo, he doesn't have gut inflammation, he absorbs nutrients better, and he puts on muscle easy. But, you know, I would argue that Wellborn is kind of genetically talented in that area when you see
some photos. He's a bit of an outlier.
He's a pretty good outlier there. But, you know, we've had some other nice vindicative stuff on this, like Frank Muir went paleo and was already a big, strong dude, but got leaner, got bigger, got stronger. You know, and he's running in that 265 to 290 kind of range. Mark Bell, who's, you know, world renowned in the powerlifting scene, has been tweeting and blogging like crazy on paleo, and it's this same deal where these guys who are pushing the outer boundaries of strength and kind of muscularity, like, he found that he has less inflammation, he recovers faster, he's stronger. Wellborn ended up doing some stuff with him. Wellborn's done some stuff with some other top of the food chain powerlifters, these guys who are winning world championships in this stuff. And they're like, dude, I recover faster, I'm bigger, I'm stronger. I think some of them use some dairy, but it's not necessarily like the gallon of milk a day kind of gig. They might throw down some whey protein, so it's kind of more like Mark Sisson-esque, you know, primal kind of gig where you generally eat paleo, eat big, and then throw down some whey protein in the post-workout window. So I think this is all easily done. I think that we've got some people at the top end of the food chain who are actually winning world championships with this stuff. And they're all, you know, finding that eating closer to paleo and then being kind of smart about what you know, gray area foods they throw in, that they're really benefiting from this. And these are people that are tinkering with a lot of stuff, ranging from, you know, like what type of supportive gear they're wearing and it, you know, for their bench shirt and, you know, all kinds of stuff in their training program. So I suspect that this isn't like an aberrant finding. Like these dudes are competing at the outer edge of human performance and they're finding some good benefit from this. And that's just kind of one chunk. And then this other side, like the gallon of milk a day is definitely a potent growth promoter. It's, you know, 3,000 calories of food that, you know, protein, carbs, fat, good ratio, all that sort of jive. But the growth-promoting properties of dairy are very nonspecific. Like, they just make you big everywhere, including your belly. And
your face. Usually that'll give you a nice fat face.
Yeah, I mean, you get a lot of kind of systemic inflammation. You get that abdominal adiposity. You get a big fat, visceral adiposity deposition, which that's the worst place in the world to carry body fat. It's the stuff that has the highest concentration of aromatase, so it converts testosterone into estrogen. It increases your likelihood of breast, colon, and prostate cancer. So, you know.
Yeah, any of you have ever got the chance to work on cadavers, tell me that's not gnarly when you got one of those chubby ones.
Oh, dude, it's, yeah, ugh. Yeah, when you are trying to like discern the gallbladder or something, and you have to carve through like 8 or 12 inches of just like gelatinous momentum, it's super gnarly. But
yeah,
so I don't know. Those are my thoughts on it. Like, we're seeing people who are actually winning world championships in strength athletics. The dude that just won the Arnold's strongman event, apparently at the end of that he was like paleo, 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 and then you've got like Mark Bell, you got John Wellborn and the dudes that are training with John. We've done some stuff with some O-lifters at the Olympic Training Center and everything. And I think some paleo plus dairy works phenomenally well. But, you know, it just that gallon O milk and then a bunch of junk food, just I think that there's way more intelligent ways that you can go about that. And I'm just kind of hanging my hat on the feedback that I'm getting from people who are registering actual world championship status on stuff. So
typically good people to listen to.
Probably half decent people to look to. Maybe again, statistical outliers. You know, I mean, we don't always want to hang our hat on world champions, because some of these people, you know, they can do whatever they want to and they're going to win. But when folks have been eating more along this kind of gallon of milk, seafood, you know, like eat anything under the sun, and they shift to a cleaner diet and they get better results, and it's, you know, there's no problem with getting the caloric content and all that stuff. It's kind of compelling to me. So, and there again, you know, just get in and try it on for a while. But, you know, the big picture on this thing, be clear about what you want out of your training. Whenever I hang out around Wellborn, like, he thinks that anybody under 300 pounds is not even worthy of citizenship, basically. And I'm just like,
that's going to be a small band of people.
Yeah, seriously. So, you know, it's like, so I could fight my genetics, try really, really hard to be big, and I might break 200 pounds and I'll look like a fire plug. Or I can kind of go with my genetics, be reasonably, you know, strong for my body weight, be lean, actually be in a position in which my wife wants to sleep with me, and I'm probably not going to die when I'm 45. So I would just be real clear about what you want to get out of this stuff.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that's what I wanted to address here, is that it seems very clear what you want, and that is to not weigh 260 pounds, yeah, but to get stronger. And, I, you know, like Rob said, you have to ask yourself what your goal is. And if your goal is not gaining weight, then you need to not do this in a way that makes gaining weight a primary goal. And so to answer your question, it's entirely possible to gain significant amounts of strength without putting on significant amount of body weight. People do it all the time in weight class sports, such as weightlifting, for example. And so much of that has to do with how you structure your training. And I feel like we addressed this like one or two podcasts ago, with regard to a woman who didn't want to get bulky. If
right.
you keep your training relatively low rep, not necessarily super low volume, but, you know, relatively low volume, then you're going to be getting strength gains more as a product of neurological improvements rather than morphological. In other words, you're not going to be laying down huge amounts of new muscle to get that new strength. So, you know, that you definitely don't need to do a gallon of milk a day. Stick with the way you want to eat. Make sure it's adequate for what you want to do and appropriate. And then make sure your training is tailored to what you want. And I think it's really that simple.
Yeah.
Just be yourself, man.
I just got to be me.
All right. Bobby says, hey, Greg and Rob, I'm 30 years old and I have been training pretty consistently now for about 6 years. Quote, crossfitting for the last 2.5. I have a background in wrestling and triathlon, but now I'm biasing my training toward powerlifting and strongman. Strange transition, I know. And have recently competed in a few events with decent results. I do eat fairly strict paleo with some dairy products thrown in. My question has to do with coaching rather than diet. I'm level 1 CrossFit certified and would like to pursue coaching. However, I'm very aware that there are significant flaws in the strict CrossFit methodology. I do want to coach in a CrossFit box. However, I do not want to be a coach who relies solely on the main site WODS and information that is drip fed down from headquarters, like so many unfortunately do. I've heard you advise people to go to gyms where staff are actually qualified to do personal training and have an idea of what to do with people who present special challenges, fibromyalgia, for instance. Here's my problem. I've had some success programming for myself with quite a lot of trial and error, but I still do not feel confident to program for others, especially special populations. I'm uncomfortable with the idea of trial and error with others. Are there good books to read, courses to take, websites/organizations to look up? Is the NSCA a good starting place or not? What else is out there? A lot of people around me are telling me to just start using the main site WODS with clients. Oh my God. And progress my knowledge from there, but I can't help think that there must be a more scientific and tailored starting point. I guess the crux of my question is, where do you learn how to effectively program for individuals without hurting them? I want to be a high quality coach within CrossFit, not just another CrossFit quote coach. Any advice would be welcome. Thanks for all you guys do. First of all, I just need to say, God bless you for recognizing that starting with the CrossFit.com workouts for your clients and learning from there is not the best way to go. Yeah. Rob, would you like to continue from there?
Gosh, just a lot of stuff kind of percolates to the surface on this when I'm thinking about all this. You know, it's where to look. You know, like when Greg... when Catalyst is offering a seminar, I would go check that out. If Ido Portal has a seminar, I would check that out. Pulikan stuff is good. I would check that out. OPT's got some good stuff. I would just look at some people who are well established in what they're doing and just kind of round out your offerings from there. I would really recommend reading the numerous posts that both my wife and I have written on her blog, NikkiVialetti.com. in which we actually talk about how we structure our business and how we weave in the training and the business systems to best effect so that we actually have a systematic approach to the way that we bring people through the process. And it shines a light on how we've adopted, some stuff like Michael Rutherford's Max Effort Black Box and, you know, a more strength-oriented approach, strength and skill-oriented approach to training. Bringing in Dave Warner's skill standards and kind of modifying those to create a multi-tiered, program for our folks. Those are the things that I think when you start thinking through, clients come into your gym. What's their first contact? Phone call, email, walk-in, maybe now at this point like a social media contact. How do you triage those people? And, you know, like in at NorCal, we do a 30-minute fitness evaluation where somebody talks to them and listens to what they want, and we check out like shoulder and hip and scapular mobility and all that stuff and kind of get a sense of would they be appropriate for one-on-one or the on-ramp, and then we start pumping them through the program. And if you've got some sort of a system in place and some thought about progression instead of scaling, then the coaching, I wouldn't say that it becomes self-evident, but it becomes a lot more clear. You know, like I really still love the classic CrossFit workout, Diane, the 21-15-9 deadlift handstand pushup. I just kind of dig it. I think it's a cool workout. But I think that would be a horrible workout to introduce to somebody on their first day in the gym. Like they've never deadlifted before. And the standard of care out of the CrossFit scene is that you would just give that person a PVC and they would do 21-15-9 deadlift, you know, with a PVC and then maybe presses with the PVC, and that would be their first introduction. And is that better than the person continuing to sit on the couch? Yes. Is that the best way that you could pump somebody through an effective strength and conditioning program? Absolutely not. You know, if you read some books like The Talent Code, it's clear that the number of repetitions that you do in an activity and the qualitative nature of that activity, that's what lays down the myelination. That's what lays down the neural learning for people. And so if you give this airplay to what was it? The gymnastics term, for quality, like Glassman talked about it all the time.
Virtuosity.
So if you want virtuosity, you've got to actually train that movement as close to perfection as you can. And so squatting, deadlifting, pressing, learning the basic scapular retraction elements on like a body row and stuff like that, those things need to be performed in a way that, they aren't poor technique. Or you practice three or four sets of good technique, and then you do something like a Diane workout where the technique goes out the window, and you lay down 50 repetitions of bad technique. The higher intensity, more voluminous training is what's going to win in that case. And so that's where, for us, like our elements, on-ramp class, people, we're not using deadlifts as a conditioning tool. We'll work deadlifts as a strength modality. And then we'll do some things like bear crawls and prowler pushes and med ball slams and stuff like that. Some kind of low motor unit or simple motor recruitment movements that aren't going to bugger the things that we want people to get good at, namely strength movements. And so I think those are some ways to, tackle all this stuff. And we've talked about it a lot in previous podcasts. So I won't beat that drum too much, but think about the way that you're systematically bringing people through your system. Check out John Wellborn's seminar. At some point we're going to have like a NorCal method business seminar in a brushing of the way that we introduce movement in our program. It's going to be more focused on just business systems themselves, but part of the business systems is actually being effective in the way that you coach movement. So we'll brush on that stuff a little bit. Greg, any other thoughts or people that you would recommend that they go do some training with?
Well, no, I want to agree with you generally that, a good idea is to look to the people that you respect and who seem to be doing the type of training and type of business that you would like to be doing and find ways to learn from them. And fortunately, in this day and age, most of those kind of people put out a ton of content either online for free or through books and DVDs that you got to pay a little bit for, but in the grand scheme of things, are incredibly inexpensive relative to, say, a college education. Beyond that, if you can, and bug these people, not me because we don't offer this, but bug these people for internships or some kind of like mentorship program, because there's really, in my opinion, no better way to learn how to do this stuff than getting into the environment where it's actually being done, observing, helping, speaking to the coaches, speaking to the clients, and, really being present in that environment rather than trying to view it from a distance and kind of reverse engineer the stuff. Like I said, that's not always possible or it's not always practical. I literally get emails a couple times a week from people looking for internships here, and we just unfortunately are not set up to do anything. I would love to be able to do it in the future, but because I absolutely recognize the value. And then, of course, Rob and I both have recommended reading lists on our websites, so that's a good place to start in terms of actual just study materials. And then, I really think you need to get out and try to visit as many gyms as you can rather than staying in the gym you're in right now, which it sounds like, I guess maybe it's not clear here if you're currently working for a CrossFit gym or you have one in mind that's going to hire you or something. But before you totally settle in, I would try to kind of bounce around to a few places and really interact with a few people and bring back some ideas before you get started. And the big thing too is that you are smart enough here to recognize that there are certain people or certain situations that you're not comfortable with as a trainer. And that's good. It's a good thing that you're that conscious of your present abilities and knowledge. A lot of people are not. And so take advantage of that. Be the respectable, good trainer who says, hey, this is outside my wheelhouse. I'm going to bring in someone else to give me some advice, or I'm going to refer you to someone who's, you know, more appropriately suited for you. And anytime you refer someone or anytime you bring on someone to consult, to help you with a certain client or a certain issue, that's such a perfect opportunity for you to learn and to actually add that ability and that knowledge to your own. And so, you know, never refer someone away and then never have any contact with them or the person to whom you referred them. You know, always check back in with them, play some kind of active role with that, and there's plenty you can take away.
I think Eric Cressy and Mike Boyle both have some really robust internship programs.
So, I think Mike Robertson's on that list too. Yeah. I think they're all doing the same thing.
Cool.
All right. Good question, though.
Let's see here. Brian says, Robin Gregg, I'm still a relatively young for a strength coach, 25, but I've been in and around the collegiate strength and conditioning as well as private training scene for 6 years. The one thing I see strength coaches agree less on than anything else is the use of percentages. A strength coach that I have a lot of respect for looked at one of my programs and asked me why I didn't include percentages. All I could think was, percentages of what? Greg, I know you use percentages on your website. When I see 85% times 1 times 3, is that 85% of what my one rep max is when I've had 10 hours of sleep, no stress, and I'm gloating over a colleague being rated 96th the most influential person in fitness? Oh, God.
The backstories.
Yeah, you guys are going to have to listen to some podcasts in recent history to figure out that one if you don't know it. Or do I take into account that my girlfriend just ran off with the pool boy and I got 4 hours of sleep last night after my new puppy filled the house with his best work? Considering that I'm not feeling my best, how would I adjust the percentage? Typically, I go with Eric Cressy's approach of going as heavy as I can for a given rep scheme that day, then making sure I've done at least 90% of that load for a given number of repetitions. For example, if I was going for a heavy triple on shoulder press, my rep scheme might look like this. 3 rep max, then 3 sets of 3 at or above 90%. So if we're warmed up to a 3 rep max by going 135 times 3, 155 times 3, 185 times 3, then 200 times 3 for a max that day, I would still need to just get 2 more sets of 3 reps at least 180 pounds. I know there are a bunch of ways to get strong, but what are your thoughts on set percentages versus a more West Side, quote, feel it out approach? Thanks.
You want to take a stab at this first?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I do use percentages on my website most of the time. Not always, though. You can find cycles on there that don't have any percentages at all. And I do use percentages a reasonable amount of the time on the website simply because I don't know who you are. You know, there has to be some way that I can guide you in picking weights for these workouts because you're a strange person to me. I've never seen you train. I don't get to see you train on a day-to-day basis. And quite honestly, when I don't put percentages, I get flooded with emails and private messages and all kinds of stuff. Like, what do I do? How do I feel this weight out? So that's the main reason I use percentages. If you have an athlete that you're very familiar with, you know, for example, you know, one of my lifters who I've been coaching for a couple years, I see them train day in, day out. I have a very good feel for what they're capable of. It's not that hard to prescribe percentages and be pretty confident that they're going to be what I'm trying to accomplish. A good example for using for not using percentages is brand new lifters. One, because you don't really have that that history with them. You don't really know how they're going to respond to certain things. But also because their abilities are changing so rapidly that you don't want to lock them into any given weight. That being said, you can still prescribe percentages or prescribe weights and then be flexible with them based on how that person looks, feels, whatever. So for example, I may write a cycle that's, you know, 6 to 12 weeks long. I may actually prescribe percentages for that entire duration. But usually what I do is I only give my lifters 1 week of that program at a time. And I tell them, you know, they know that here's what we're planning to do. It's not set in stone. And I'm out there with them every single day watching what they're doing, taking notes literally and figuratively in my head. And then I'm adjusting their program. So even if I only give them a week at a time, I may adjust that week 5 times over the course of that week. It totally depends on what's happening. There's other times when it needs no adjustment. So if you have a plan, you have to understand that it is that, a plan. It is not, it's not totally rigid and inflexible. You have to be able to adjust according to how you're working, because there are days when your girlfriend runs off with the pool boy and you get 4 hours of sleep. In fact, if that happens, you're lucky to get 4 hours of sleep. But that being said, you don't want to completely abandon a plan because you expect these occasional problems. Now, regarding Eric Cressy's thing, I don't know where that system originated, but the place that I've first saw it is actually Dr. Kyle Pierce and Dr. Mike Stone doing, you know, working up to whatever your rep scheme is for that day, working up to a max for that, and then backing off for a certain number of sets, you know, between 85 and 90% of that. I have used programs like that before. Sometimes they work well for certain people. Sometimes it's absolutely terrible. And it really depends on the person, because some people can push themselves to the point of absolutely destroying themselves. So you take one person, you say, okay, I want you to work up to your 3-rep max. They will work up to what they feel is a 3-rep max, and they're not really pushing themselves that hard. You take someone else, work up to a 3-rep max, and they can't walk for 4 days. So, you know, you have to take that into account too. And before I forget, going back to 85% times 1 times 3, you know, what is that a percentage of? It's a percentage of what would be considered your current 1-rep max of that exercise. So, you know, within a reasonable amount of time, a couple months or something like that. You know, what this really comes down to is that you cannot, in my opinion, say, this is my system, this is the only way I do things, this is going to work ideally for everybody, and then just leave it at that. Because that's just not how it works in the real world. You have to write programs for people according to who those people are, the circumstances of their lives, what they're trying to accomplish, you know, what role this training plays in their lives relative to career, family, whatever. And instead of saying that, well, I don't use percentages because things might happen, or I do use percentages because I need to have this plan. Like, you've got to figure out a plan for each person or set of people who have similar circumstances. What do you think about that, Rob?
I dig it. The only thing that I would add, like, on that kind of somewhat intuitive, like, Abhijeev, you know, Cressy-esque thing, you know, like, find a 3-rep max, back it off, do 3 sets of 3 at 90%. In my experience, where that works is when people understand that even on that 3-rep, quote, max, bar speed needs to be fast. And we're talking, whether it's a bench, whether it's a back squat, a deadlift, like whatever the thing is, the bar speed still needs to be fast, and you need to be non-emotionally, you know, psyched for that event. So this is not a powerlifting meet. This is, you know, where you're headbutting the bar and getting a max. I think where people, and Greg alluded to this, is that people can beat themselves down with this other approach. If you go too hard on that, then it's too systemically demanding, and that's where you have to then start peeling in and putting in a prescribed percentage, I think, a little bit more often, because you're actually, you know, you need to rein people in a little bit more. So I think that people can use a little bit more of a flexible, intuitive approach, like he mentioned with this Cressy kind of gig, and I think Abhijeev is one of the people that use this stuff a bunch. And but the critical part to that is this is a non-psyched, non-emotionally, you know, wound up type of, quote, max. And it's the bar speed still got to be fast. When the bar speed starts dropping and you start grinding, then it becomes much more neurologically and systemically demanding, and you've gone too far. Like, you're going to dig too deep of a hole, and the stimulate versus annihilate thing is kind of getting lost. So if you're going to play with that stuff, whether you're doing it or whether you're coaching people, really keep that in mind, that the bar speed is really important. The bar should be moving quickly on even like these, you know, 3-rep max. And basically what it's saying is there should always be a little bit more left in the tank. You know, even on stuff like 5x5s and whatnot, like if you really get in and look at how people are talking about it, you always should have a few more reps left in the tank, and then you're slowly progressing that stuff. You can't train ovaries to the wall every day all the time. It's actually very rare that you can go in and really smash yourself and not face a pretty long recovery from that exposure.
Yeah, and it's something I've had to say repeatedly to people that I prescribe programs like that is, you know, your 3-rep max or whatever it is, there should be absolutely zero chance of a failed rep. You know what I mean? And because to me, that's clear. It should be obvious, but it's not to people. You know what I mean? And I'll get these emails from people like, oh, yeah, I was doing my 5-rep max and I failed on the 3rd rep. It's like, that's not even close. What are you doing? You know what I mean? Ah, yeah, I'm tired. I feel beat up. It's like, yes, because you're doing it wrong. So that's really important to keep in mind. And again, though, that comes down to the fact that people are going to approach that differently. And some people are intuitively going to understand what Rob is saying, and some will absolutely not get that. They see the word max, and they want to absolutely dig themselves into the deepest hole possible every single time.
Cool.
All right. Can we move on?
Yes.
Oh, God. Maybe we shouldn't have moved on. I just looked at this next one. Okay.
This Alan will be says, quick, I promise.
Rob, love your podcast. I recently read an article in the LA Times that reports about a Harvard medical study that indicates that all red meat, any amount and any type, is bad for you. Must be a good study. I've been mostly paleo for the better part of 1.5 years, and I've seen great results in terms of strength, weight loss, muscle recovery, etc. While I enjoy the paleo lifestyle, I don't want to increase my chance of early mortality by 19%. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on the study, or if you can make suggestions on other studies that indicate otherwise. A fan of your podcast, Alan.
Dude, so I hopefully folks have found, although by my Twitter feed and whatnot, it's obvious that they have not found it yet, but we did a post on this, and I definitely addressed this. So, you know, the big takeaways from this stuff is that every 2 or 3 months, you know, it's like, red meat will kill you. And then when you look at the study, what these things are is they have people keep a food log, and they record what they seem to remember eating, and then they do some statistical analysis on this stuff. And inevitably, the people doing the statistical analysis are going in already with an axe to grind against, you know, red meat or saturated fat or whatever the soup du jour happens to be. And so this is what the story was with this. This was a retrospective cohort study where they basically had people try to recall what they had eaten and the approximate amounts, and they did it on like a month-by-month basis or something like that. And so, you know, it's just – even saying that this is science is just, at this point, ridiculous. I mean, it is so filled – there was a – what do they call these things? A food frequency questionnaires. There's been a bunch of call to just do away with the food frequency questionnaire entirely. And this thing is just the backbone of epidemiology because this stuff is cheap and it's easy to kind of implement. And it looks like you're doing science, but it is just bullshit. I mean, it is wanton bullshit. You know, it's at this point, anything like this should not be funded. We should be doing metabolic ward, crossover designed, clinical trials. We should not be dicking around with this stuff anymore. At this point, it's like, let's put this stuff head to head, either apply it in sick populations, healthy populations, you know, whatever you want to do. But we need to quit screwing around with this stuff and actually run this stuff head to head. In the news piece, one of the most concerning features that popped up for me was that when people were looking at this study, they said, well, Rob, if people ate grass-fed meat, then they would have a different result. And this is something that just makes me bleed from the ears. It's like, no, because the data that they collected is worthless. It's like they collected data on how many birds flew over your house, and that somehow correlated with, like, breast, colon, prostate cancer. I mean, it's not even saying the correlation versus causation is spurious gives this study more weight than it deserves. I mean, it's just bollocks. I don't I'm kind of stumped at how to explain that more clearly. Like, the data set that they collected is just worthless. And I used in my write-up an example. You know, there was a piece that some folks produced that basically said that increased starch intake was correlative with increased rates of breast cancer in cancer survivors. So these people had cancer once, and then they were tracking via a food frequency questionnaire the amounts of like protein, carbohydrate, and fat that these people were consuming. And in this study, interestingly, they were being counseled to eat a vegan, like, plant-based diet. And they found some correlation between starch intake and increased cancer rates. Now, I would love to jump up and down on this thing and say, you know, do the shitty science that these assholes did and say, look at this, carbs cause cancer. But it's the same spurious reasoning. They did a food frequency questionnaire, and then when they did their data analysis, they were ascribing differences in cancer frequency to as little as 3 grams of starch per day in the different cohorts. I mean,
that seems reasonable.
It's just fucking ridiculous. And you know, you just can't hang your hat on this stuff. So even though I would like to ship that thing around, you know, it's kind of like the riposte, the counterpoint to this meat piece, that would be as bad as giving this thing airplay in the beginning. And so, like, I don't know, it's kind of funny. Like, I'm not religious at all, but lamentations or some, you know, the deal with Moses, and it's like, hey, I've come down out of the mountains and I have these tablets from God and you guys should do X, Y, and Z. And then the people are like, go fuck yourself. You know, it's like people have been eating this paleo shtick. They look, feel, and perform better. Their biomarkers of health and disease improve. And then every time a crap study comes down the pipe, it's like, oh my God, you know, everything changed. Science changed. It's like, no, science didn't change. Assholes in academic institutions did poorly designed studies. Don't freak out. You know, so this might be like the last time that I tackle one of these things. I may just continue to refer back to like this thing because it's going to happen again. People are going to freak out. I remember there was a study. It was maybe like 4 years ago where they, you know, they were ascribing all these negative attributes to processed meat. And one of the things that was in the processed meat category was, quote, pizza. And so the fact that sausage and pepperoni were on the pizza, when they got in and did their data analysis on the whole thing, the total caloric content of that pizza was ascribed to meat. And so this is the type of shit that passes off as science, you know, from our research institutions. And I get that not everybody has a scientific background and stuff like that. But, you know, being an informed citizen, you should be at a point of being able to say, okay, what type of study was this thing? Was it an epidemiological, like, food frequency questionnaire kind of gig? Or was this a metabolic ward clinical trial? You know, where like every bit of food that people were eating was analyzed, every bit of poop and urine that they created was analyzed. That starts getting into the gold standard when we've got some sort of metabolic ward crossover, you know, clinical trial thing. This other stuff is not worth lining a birdcage. God, do I want to say it this way? I guess so. I would just, you know, have a little bit more faith in the science that you guys have learned. Have a little bit more faith in the results that you've had. Don't just freak out and assume that this bad science has any bearing on things. At least sit down, read through the study design, and do a little bit of analysis on your own. The sun will come up tomorrow.
There's definitely a need for the common person to be a bit more discerning.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's. I think the most stunning part of these types of things is the level of irresponsibility I see from these guys, not so much even doing really, really poorly structured studies, but drawing the conclusions that they do and then making them public. I mean, that to me is the absolutely incredible part. And how you can pull that off in what is considered to be like the gold standard of research publishing, you know, peer-reviewed studies, all this bullshit. Well, it's like, if your peers can't even tell you that that study is a complete waste of time, like, I don't know what to do. You know what I mean? Other than say, you better read the whole thing and use a little bit of goddamn reason before you draw conclusions like that. Yeah. Fudge.
Yeah. And I mean, this is where a ton of our research money goes into stuff like this. And I had a back and forth with some folks who are in epidemiology, and they were kind of defending this point, and I'm pretty inflexible on this. Like, the time for research like this is done. We should never fund another like food frequency questionnaire study. All of that money should go into clinical trials, metabolic ward quality. They're very expensive. They're complex to run, and that doesn't matter. If we want some answers other than your own personal experience, which I tend to kind of ascribe a lot of value to, but if you want some more global answers to these questions, that's what we need to fund. We need to step up to the plate, do the big kid science, and quit dicking around with this stuff. And that's kind of the long and the short of it. And if this puts a bunch of poorly trained scientists out of work, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to do some work retraining and call it good. I'm sorry I'm a dick on that point. But this just reshuffling of the cards, protein, carbs, fat, is this good, is this bad, with no steeping in evolutionary biology, with no orientation towards like a guiding principle to even consider, are we even asking a question that's worth asking? Is it even couched in a term that is worth investigating? We don't even have that stuff going on. So it's a remarkable waste of time, and we need to get better. We need to get more sophisticated than that. And allowing this shoddy science to pass muster is not doing anybody any favors.
Yeah.
That's all I've got to say on that.
Well, as much as you're probably sick of answering questions like that, I kind of like doing them because it gets you all pissed off.
It does. It gets me a little spun. So,
all right. Well, here's a super depressing one.
Yeah, seriously.
Let's see. Kay says, "What's up, Rob and that other dude?" Just joking. What's up, Greg? I'm 25 years old and an avid follower of the podcast and all things paleo. Been a strict paleo eater for about a year and a half now, and I'm constantly researching and learning as much as I can. 3.5 weeks ago, I was living my dream, going to university, studying nutrition and biochemistry, working as a professional skydiver, filming tandems and teaching people how to fly wingsuits, gigging music on weekends, lifting heavy and focusing on strength with prior experience and overtraining in CrossFit, and eating well. I came back from school on Wednesday, February 15th, and went to make a few practice jumps before leaving that evening for a canopy piloting competition in California. My passion in the sport is canopy flying very small, very fast parachutes with focus on speed, distance, and accuracy. It's the most dangerous discipline in skydiving with little margin for error. For those of you interested, look up swooping. Anyway, I had a catastrophic accident which has effectively changed my life. I shattered my back at T12, broke my right ankle and left tib fib. I went in for emergency surgery that day and had my spine fused from T3 to T12 with reconstruction of T12. I also developed compartment syndrome in both thighs and my right leg, resulting in big-time fasciotomies. I have sutures down the entire length of my back on both sides from my hips to my knees and down the entire right leg on the inside and outside. As of now, I'm a paraplegic with no bowel, bladder, or sexual function. I have some patchy sensation in my legs, so there is hope. I started rehab and was there for a week but was pulled out 5 days ago because the incision in my back split open and became infected. Wound revision surgery was carried out, and that's where I am now as of this writing. Pretty gnarly shit. I find it rather comedic that the food here in the hospital is so crappy. Being a place for healing, wouldn't you really think they'd get their shit together? Rhetorical question. I've been ordering as much real food as I can, meat, veggies, fruit, and have had friends bring me some stuff, but avoiding additives, preservatives, and the like is not totally possible here. I'm at a fantastic facility, Barrows Institute in Arizona, that is world-renowned for spinal care. I've already had the dietitian talk to me once about the importance of eating heart-healthy whole grains and told me I shouldn't keep avoiding them and that I should be careful of my moderate to large meat consumption. I smiled, nodded, and wanted to punch her in the face. She was fat. I guess my question is, what would be your dietary supplemental focus if you were in my situation? My body has gone through a shitload of trauma and still is. I know miracles happen, and I so hope I'll be able to walk again. But nonetheless, how should I eat to promote the best progress? Before, I was eating high fat, high protein, low carb on non-workout days, and high carb, high protein, low fat on workout days. I would say my hospital intake has been low fat, high carb, moderate protein, if I had to guess. What general ratio would you recommend? 40, 30, 30? Just kidding. What supplements would you recommend, if any? Any other advice? Thoughts? I'm going through a lot right now, emotionally and physically. The big thing, I guess, is coping. I appreciate all you guys do for the world. You are truly amazing individuals. K. P.S. I apologize for incorrect grammar, run-ons, etc. I am high on fentanyl.
Nice. Jesus,
well, first
man.
Thing I have to say is, Jesus Christ, K, you have probably the best attitude I can imagine in your situation. I would be a raging asshole.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, shit. I don't know what to say other than big, big props to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Like, words kind of fail with this stuff. So I huge props to you. You know, cutting to the chase, like, what would I do in this? I would eat a ketogenic diet, like moderate to low protein, high fat, low carb. There's been a ton of work on traumatic brain injuries, on spinal cord injuries. A lot of it coming out of Japan, where they will actually, instead of like in general, if somebody is put on an IV drip, it's like a lactate ringer's solution, carbohydrate derivative, you know, a lactate, and instead of that, they put folks on a ketone ringer solution. They put folks on a ketogenic diet. One of the problems under a spinal cord injury or like traumatic brain injury, the biggest problem isn't the initial injury. It's the ensuing inflammatory response, which then kills neurons, and the neurons are very slow to grow back, if at all. Like, for a long time, they said they didn't grow back, and now we're saying, okay, maybe they do, but it takes, you know, ages and ages and ages for that to happen. So the big determinant in this stuff is how much inflammatory response do you have at the injury site, and then, you know, what type of nerve death do you experience? And there just seems to be crystal clear data on the fact that ketosis and a ketogenic state tends to stabilize calcium homeostasis. Calcium homeostasis is critical in whether or not a nerve cell or cells in general live or die. This is one of the problems with training to failure a la CrossFit, is that when you completely deplete the fuel substrates of a cell in a non-adaptive, like very severe manner, then you can't stabilize calcium homeostasis. Calcium floods the cell undergoes apoptosis, get rhabdomyolysis, and all that fun stuff. And so, you know, for me, like, I wish that the standard of care, I wish that the neurosurgeons and the folks who are working with you were educated on the fact that a ketogenic intervention could be hugely powerful in stabilizing the inflammatory process, minimizing neuronal cell death, and giving you the best fighting chance that you have to recover and maintain whatever functionality you were going to have. And then from there, this ketogenic state... The neurological tissue is stabilized under ketosis. It, you know, part of the problem that also exacerbates all this is that if you start becoming insulin resistant, then the neurological tissue cannot access fat as an energy source because they've got to use ketone bodies for that. And then they also can't access glucose as an energy source. And that's when that's so much of the problems with like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, the reactive oxygen species, the inflammatory response. That's a part of it, but part of it is just that the cells are actually starving. They're dying. That's what happens in diabetic peripheral neuropathy. So why we would feed somebody who is now comparatively sedentary a high-carb diet, which is going to feed into this metabolic derangement, that just seems ridiculous to me. And it's borders on, you know, malpractice kind of gig that people are not educated on this topic. Like it's time to step folks' games up. When I was at Paleo FX, who was it? It was Dr. Amy Myers, who's a functional medicine doc. She was talking about, you know, people who have different, say like GI problems, and then their primary care physician or their rheumatologist or whatever wants them to start eating gluten again, so that they can prove via blood work that the person is reactive to it. And she feels like that recommendation is paramount to malpractice, because you're exposing somebody to a known carcinogen, to a known food entity that can kill them. And it's not always clear that they're going to come back positive on the The blood work, whereas an elimination diet has no potential downside, and if the person looks, feels, and performs better, then we've pretty much done our job. So I think the medical scene definitely needs to step its game up here. So ketogenic diet, supplementation, you know, some insulin sensitizers, like maybe a little bit of alpha lipoic acid, like 100 milligrams a day. You don't want to go overboard on that because it can be kind of hypoglycemic inducing. So I don't know. That's what I've got. And definitely keep us posted. Let us know what's going on.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'd say we should probably wrap up there.
You want to wrap up there? Okay.
Yep. So anything else going on you need to announce to your loyal listeners?
Not too much. We're about 5 weeks out as of this Thursday from the Wolf Cub projected arrival. So we'll see how I do with all that. See how perky I am when the sleep deprivation sets in. So
is he or she going to be joining us on the podcast?
probably at some point. I don't imagine initially, but yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm just worried if I'm going to lose my job.
No. I think you've got some job security for about 16 years for sure.
Ah, awesome. Nothing like being replaced by a 16-year-old.
Seriously.
Cool, man.
All right, well, T, thanks for everything. And so we'll remind folks that you'll have some information product on the Catalyst site probably the day after this goes up, yeah?
Oh, yes. The portable Greg Everett. For you Henry Rollins fans, you'll get that.
Nice.
So that'll be an ebook. Should be out right now while you're listening to this. And so check that out.
Cool. Right on, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
Okay. See you later.